Good evening and welcome to Larry Berman's presidency class. And you are part of now the White House Communications class at Towson University. And we began, our semester system works different than yours, and so we began in February. And we would like to welcome tonight Elaine Quijano from CNN. And she's going to talk to us about White House reporting from the angle of television and a cable news reporter. We've had Wire, and we've had newspaper. We've had magazine reporters. We've had we've also had internet and newspaper. With Mike Allen was our guest last week. And we've also had the White House side from Tony Fratto. And so tonight we will enjoy talking to Elaine about how she does her work and how that compares with the kind of reporting techniques and strategies and interrelationships with the White House that others have had. Welcome, Elaine.
Thank you.
And I wonder if you can start by telling us how you landed at CNN. What was your path there, starting out with your education?
Well, I started off actually going into my freshman year at the University of Illinois, Champaign-Urbana, thinking I would come out with an engineering degree. That was sort of the path that had been laid out to me. My sister went to MIT, and so it was sort of the tradition in our family that sciences were the way to go. Well, I quickly found out that that would probably not work out for me, and on a whim took a intro to broadcast journalism class. So it was a professor that I had at the University of Illinois, his name was Robin Kaler, who really sort of encouraged me to, if I really enjoyed her class by the end of the semester, to pursue internships, and sort of the rest, as they say, is history. So I did that, and I was hooked, and eventually followed the path that a lot of television people do, which is you start off in a small market. My first job was in, I like to say I worked at CIA, but it's WCIA, which stands for Central Illinois Area. Interesting factoid, Dana Perino, White House Press Secretary, also spent some time working at WCIA. But after a few years there, went on to an ABC affiliate in Tampa, Florida. Spent some time there before coming to Washington in late 2000, where I started working for CNN News Source, which is the affiliate service for CNN, and eventually moved over to the network side, and eventually was asked to help out on the campaign trail back in 2004. So that is sort of how I fell into the White House beat, and it was after sort of covering the White House off and on since 2004, really, that I eventually was made an official sort of White House correspondent.
In the various places that you've worked, have you found that that reporting is different? The kinds of things you do are different developing a story, or are they similar?
Well, they're very similar, I think. You know, ultimately, whether you're covering local politics or politics at this level, ultimately, people are people, and they have their motivations, and you know, the desire for power is somewhat universal. So there are a lot of similarities. I apologize for my voice, as Martha knows. I'm kind of battling a cold here, so pardon the throat.
And laryngitis.
And I had laryngitis a few days ago. My colleagues can attest to that. But I found that there is a similar thread, really, that kind of runs through a lot of the stories. I like to try to bring a different perspective, since I didn't grow up professionally, quote unquote, inside the Beltway. A lot of, you know, a lot of my colleagues have done that. It's very easy for me to sometimes you get caught up in a lot of the minutiae, but for a television audience, obviously, you've got sometimes 90 seconds tops and one pass to do it to get the salient points out to your audience in a way that will capture their attention and imagination. And depending whether or not it's a straight live shot or if it's a taped piece, it's still a very limited amount of time, unlike print, where you can go back and someone can reread something. And if you lose the viewer, they're on to something else. So a lot of times, I'm applying sort of the same principles that I learned early on in my career to what I'm doing mm-hmm. now. But obviously, it's a much more complex situation here in Washington, where I would say one of the biggest challenges is sort of sorting through the nuance. You know, for television, sometimes that can be a big challenge, is sort of cutting right to the essence. And as we are a 24/7 cable operation, it's a very fast environment that we work in. So we've got to make sure that, you know, A, of course, we've got it right. But then if we're trying to present, in addition to sort of the play-by-play, some of the color commentary, as I like to think of it, some of the analysis, that we're also doing that in a compelling way with the limited sort of time that we have to work with.
Do you find the barriers at this level to getting the news you want higher or lower than when you're working at the state and local level?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely the thing about the White House, obviously, is, you know, there's only a certain number of doors you can knock on, and it's such a highly competitive business that we are in. Oftentimes, many people are knocking on those same exact doors to get the information, and even sometimes within the network, you will find beats overlap, and so you can be constrained. But it is, particularly with this White House, I mean, it's a tough nut to crack. You know, people describe it as sort of pulling teeth sometimes to try and get people to go on record, for instance. You know, that has been sort of a point of contention, is a lot of times, mm-hmm. why can't officials give these seemingly benign statements on the record, that there's sort of this aversion to doing so, that we're sort of constantly fighting that. And, you know, it can be a challenge, you know, that is where you start to go other avenues. Obviously, a lot of people on the Hill do like to talk, and that's right. where sometimes yeah. That can come in handy.
So. Do you find that there's been a difference in the time? You've covered the whole administration. Do you find that there's a difference in the willingness of people now to go on the record, that there's more information available, and it's available on a on the record basis than in earlier times?
Yeah, I mean, I think obviously there's a great deal of caution now because of the fact that we are in such a, I mean, even since the time that this president took office, things have evolved, as you know, on the communications side with mm-hmm. with the blogs and the way things can become sort of giant echo chambers. A lot of times it causes people to hold back, I think. I mean, I feel this sense of increased caution, and it really, that's where establishing your relationships with sources comes in very handy, because, you know, hopefully the idea being you can let folks know that while you may be asking tough questions, aggressive questions, that ultimately your reporting and your questions will be fair ones. But it's a challenge. I mean, it's really a challenge. I think obviously there are people who feel they've been burned and they are very reticent to speak openly about things, but or even on the background about things. But you know, we just have to
Do you think it's a case of they feel that they've been burned, or that in the earlier parts of the administration there was a general understanding? Because I know I talked to a couple of senior people independently of one another when I asked them why they didn't bring out people in the briefing room and, you know, bring out cabinet secretaries, mm-hmm. bring out domestic policy, you know, the NSC advisor, although they did bring out Condi Rice in the beginning. And both of them said the same thing: there's only one newsmaker, and that newsmaker is the president. And other people shouldn't get ink, and or airtime, and that seems to have abated somewhat. And I'm not sure if it's because Dana Perino the president has a lot of confidence in her, and is willing to take her suggestion.
Yeah, we've definitely seen more officials, I think, since she's obviously taken the position as right. press secretary. You know, we've had background briefings and on-camera briefings with officials, as you point out, but just in sort of private conversations with people, I think obviously the folks have long memories, and whether things might have been taken out of context, and sometimes you run into situations where it may not be your own reporting, but something that someone uh-huh. at your network has said, or uh-huh. even another network that causes people to sort of clam up. That's sort of what I was talking about. But right. you're right, there have been, I think, since Dana has come on board, I mean, just last week, and in fact, you're talking about the Colombia Free Trade Agreement as being an example. Well, there yeah. they had essentially a photo op with Secretary Rice and Secretary Paulson. I mean, it was sort of unheard of, this picture of this image of half a dozen or so cabinet secretaries in the briefing room trying to make the case, right. you know, yeah. that Congress needs to move on this Colombia Free Trade Agreement. So that was uh-huh. an example where people right. were brought to the front yeah. and, you know, front center and making the administration's arguments.
And they had an interesting event a few weeks earlier where they also brought in people, but they didn't bring in cabinet secretaries. They brought in three people who were experts in the Colombia Free Trade Agreement. And one of the things that we've all noticed in the briefing room is they have plasma screens now, which aren't very often used. Mm-hmm. And so that's a very high-tech operation. But one of these guys who was talking about the Colombia Free Trade Agreement, in order to bring across to reporters what was involved in the agreement, he brought a grocery bag and he brought out an apple and a Pepsi can and other items to show what was involved in the agreement, because those items from the United States faced high tariffs and when they went into Colombia. And so it was the benefit of all of the companies in the U.S. and the growers to have this agreement. But it seemed funny that here, with all of the communications gear that they've put into the White House, that you'll be down to a grocery bag. That's actually what people would understand. I think one of the only times I've seen them do use those plasma screens is when the NCAA championship started, and the guys in the lower press office turned the screens around, put on the basketball for the day, and you got it.
Right.
Yeah,
I remember that. Dana got some applause from the crew yeah. guys anyway
yeah.
for that move.
Do you find that there's certain kinds of stories that the White House is interested in having you all use, that they are more willing to provide information? Like, for example, if the president's going on a trip, that they give you background information before you go on the trip?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, even just coming up this week, we have an example where there's a Wounded Warriors event that the president is going to be having this Thursday, I believe, on the South Lawn. And already we are getting from senior administration officials notice that if we would like to have some behind-the-scenes interviews or video, B-roll, that they can accommodate us, which is a highly unusual move for, uh-huh. from our perspective, to be allowed that behind-the-scenes access and our cameras, you know, sort of in that position, because typically when we've asked for that before, they have not been able to accommodate us or willing to accommodate us. So it's, you know, it's definitely, obviously, when it's in their interest to try and provide us yeah. more material, they will do so. But, you know, it's just a matter of trying to find a balance for us. If, you know, we haven't decided what we're going to do, for instance, in that particular case, if there's what the story of the day is, because that's another issue, too, is oftentimes the message, obviously, that they want to be the message of the day is not necessarily what the rest of us in the briefing room are focusing on, as you right. know. And so yeah. therein can lie sort of the conflict yeah. as they try to steer the conversation one way, and it becomes very obvious over the course of the morning off-camera gaggle and then later on in the briefing that people's reporting is really going to be in another place. So.
Uh-huh. And at this point in the presidency, too, the story is often, it's out on the trail.
Absolutely. I mean,
we haven't had a presidential election that's been this competitive and interesting in a long time, at least since the 1968 election. So the White House is fighting a total lack of interest. So part of their strategy there may be that they're just afraid they're not getting covered.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, Cheryl Stolberg of the New York Times wrote a piece that talked about the president's being invisible on issues related to the economy. And the word invisible appeared in the headline, and it was on the front page above the fold. And the White House just went into overdrive on that one. So one of the things that they've done in the second term that they didn't do in the first is that they developed a rapid response operation that they used during the campaign that's run by two young people. And it's amazing to me that two young people can crank out all of the stuff that they do. But they, when they get upset over something, they have an email that they call Setting the Record Straight. And the one that they sent out that day on her article was a real hair fire. I never saw a Setting the Record Straight that was that angry. Mm-hmm.
They were livid. They were absolutely livid. And it was amazing because it really harkened back to the 2004 campaign trail for me. It was sort of that sense of, as you said, rapid response. Mm-hmm. And here we have, you know, the White House so obviously pointing to one report, one article, and the use of that word invisible, as you said, that really just did not sit well with them at all.
So when you read something like that, does it tell you that when they get that angry, that it's because it comes from the president?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's no doubt about it. The fact that the push came so hard and so quickly with that, really, to me, it seems obviously to have struck a nerve, because oftentimes if you'll get some pushback, you can kind of judge that perhaps they might be a little bit unhappy about something, but with this particular Setting the Record Straight, I mean, you could really feel the full force of the of the president behind that.
Yeah.
And they obviously have been working hard to try and get the president out there. When it comes to the economy, it is, you know, issue number one. CNN has sort of taken that as the name of our noon show, in fact, now on the weekdays, is issue number one, focusing on the economy, because of the fact that voters obviously are looking at their pocketbooks, and it's going to affect obviously how they vote this fall. But for the president, obviously, he has been out there trying to get across his message that his administration is on top of things, not really making news necessarily, but essentially trying to sort of repeat certain mantras of, you know, the checks are going to be in the mail on the economic stimulus package, things are going to get better, and then to have this article, and again, the use of the word invisible, essentially saying he's not been here on this issue. There's this sort of void of leadership on this issue.
Yeah.
Really, it was something I think you could tell by the response. It was very, very raw.
It was. It was throughout the whole message. Do you think in part it was because the president and his staff see the New York Times is driving news in a lot of areas, so that whether it's cable that takes cues from it, or the networks, because the networks do too. So they see an article like that in the New York Times as being particularly destructive, because it's not just people in New York that are reading. It's going to go worldwide as part of the Times, but it also is going to get picked up as legitimate. It's the legitimacy that it provides to that particular idea.
Yeah, I think that's an excellent point, because the fact that it is sort of agenda setting, you know, the idea that this would appear in this publication, I think, is something that they really wanted to counter very quickly. They knew, as you point out, the impact that the New York Times, as you say, above the fold headline like that can have. And so the idea that they needed to get out there very quickly and, as I said, very forcefully, it was something that I think there was no question they were going to do something. And when it eventually came out, it wasn't a surprise that they came out with the Setting the Record Straight. It was sort of a surprise of how forceful it was.
And how bitter, yeah. Mm-hmm. Did they have another strategy, like trying to provide information to you all on kind of why that wasn't so, why the president is not invisible? Did you find the White House, that staff people talk to you?
Yeah, I mean, they what they will oftentimes do is they will pick up the phone after we've been on a lot of times, which has happened, you know, on many occasions, that after a certain report, if there is something that they take exception with, if there's something that they feel is left out, or if they feel as though you've somehow mischaracterized their position, they will be quick to let you know either via email or a phone call. And I've certainly had my share of heated conversations with people, not necessarily just with the folks who are in the press office now, but even, you know, prior to Dana being press secretary.
Right.
And it just sort of comes with the territory and is one of the realities of the 24/7 sort of cable cycle. You know, you're on sometimes when there's a big breaking story on the hour, every hour, and it's, you know, for us, for CNN, it's not just the domestic network, it's also CNN headlines, or it's also CNN International, it's .com, it can be CNN radio. So there are a number of avenues where your material is presented, and again, they certainly monitor very closely. A lot of times it gets back to you very quickly if they are not happy with your reporting.
There's some people who have televisions that have four parts to their screen so that they can keep up make sure, and then they can hit one if they want to look at a particular report. Because I know in talking to Scott Sforza, his television, I forget how many screens it had, but it but that was his deal. How wide is the circle of people that will call? Do they have experts call? Is it mostly communications people?
Mostly communications people, I would say. And oftentimes, you know, what will happen is they will offer to put you in touch with an expert to sort of set you straight and to let you know, you know, this is the wider view here and this is why we are upset. And, you know, really it sort of depends on the situation. But in my experience, it's usually the communications folks who will have the initial conversation with you first, and then at the end of that, if you have, you know, sort of additional deeper questions, and oftentimes there's not really a resolution necessarily, there's sort of just an agreement to disagree, sort of, but you will still be presented with the offer of talking to somebody which is helpful to have that background conversation with someone.
But isn't that something that should take
it
place?
Should.
They should allow people to talk, because one of the difficulties is they're not allowing people to talk beforehand.
Right.
And in talking to the communications people anyway, like Dan Bartlett, they seem to be worried about mistakes people would make if they came out to the briefing room, that somehow they would make a mistake, like, say, Mankiw did when he was head of the Council of Economic Advisers. And in February of 2004, which was the beginning of the election, he had the annual economic report of the president and reported about outsourcing. And he said outsourcing was really good for the economy. Well, that was not a message he wanted coming out of the White House. Mm-hmm. And so for Dan, that was an example of what happens when you put an expert in touch with reporters.
Right, they want to minimize risk at all costs, right? They want to try and do whatever is the low-risk briefing, if it's a backgrounder with one reporter versus having somebody out in the middle of the briefing room, even if it's off camera. That obviously opens them up to much more to be misinterpreted, or for there to be, you know, people misspeaking. But I have, you know, I have asked for backgrounders with folks, and they have been accommodating when they, you know, find that it's in their interest to make sure we sort of, on the TV side especially, get that crystallized.
Well,
the subject is.
What about the president himself? Have you been in any sessions that have been off the record?
I have, yes.
And compare what you see of the president in an off the record session, and how many of them have you been in, and what is he like in that setting?
I've been probably to three of them since I started covering the White House back in 2004, and you know, he's obviously a lot more relaxed without the cameras there, that's for sure. People, generally speaking, walk out of there not just off the records with reporters, but even other off the records that he has with sort of columnists that, you know, they always say, well, he seems much more well-spoken in those off-the-record situations than he ever does on camera. And, you know, he's very camera conscious, obviously, and so in these off-the-record sessions, what you see is a different demeanor. You know, he is very passionate about topics, and a lot more, I think, in the weeds than people might mm-hmm. expect. You know, people mm-hmm. I think have a sense that in his speeches, you know, there are certain talking points, obviously, and certain themes that he hits. But in these off the records, he is much more detailed, I think, than people might anticipate him being, and it really demonstrates this grasp of, while he has sort of the big picture vision of what he thinks, you know, the United States' role is, especially on foreign policy issues. This is where we see a lot of this detail come to the forefront. He will talk about these intricate relationships with world leaders and very deftly explains nuance involved, which you don't really ever hear him talk about, you know, on the trail, but out when he delivers speeches. And so that is something that I've noticed is different. It's hard to explain to people because unless they've seen it, it's not necessarily the image that has been formed. And part of it, obviously, was during the 2004 campaign. That was not the image that they wanted. Yeah. They didn't want sort of the nuance out there. They wanted sort of the straightforward, regular, you know, plain-spoken Texas guy, and that was the image that was crafted for him. But I think what that's done then is sort of reinforced in people's minds that perhaps he doesn't necessarily get in the weeds on some of these issues, and he really, in those off the records, you get the sense he definitely does.
Uh-huh. So. Yeah, a lot of it really comes from decisions they made of how to portray him.
Right.
In an early decision, they portrayed him as a man who didn't read newspapers.
Right.
And he talked in an interview with Britt Hume. He talked about how he didn't read newspapers. That's what you have staff for. Mm-hmm. And in reality, he does read newspapers.
Absolutely.
I know a few. April did a interview with Laura Bush around the same time, mm-hmm. and asked her about what newspapers they read and exactly how they read them. And it was clear he read newspapers, and I could see he's read the New York Times recently. So, but they made that choice, and
right.
then it's difficult to go back on it.
Right.
Let's see. Let's take some questions.
Okay.
And Towson. You all have a question? Yeah.
Do you think that being a 24-hour cable network is an advantage in getting information from the White House, or does it put you at a disadvantage?
I actually think it's an advantage because mm-hmm. in this day and age, you know, we've already had sort of the infrastructure in place to have our own rapid communications team together, whereas I think, you know, for other organizations, they may still sort of, I'm not trying to sound like I'm tooting our horn, but the infrastructure is there because we are CNN International and we have the London Bureau that, you know, is operating before we ever wake up. You know, there is already a staff in place to sort of help us navigate, and it's a compelling argument to make then to the White House communications folks. Why we need to have some sort of response quickly because of the fact that there is this global, not just a national mm-hmm. reach, but a global reach as well. So I think it's an advantage. I think it helps us make our argument to the White House communications staff that some sort of reply, response, comment, reaction is needed when an issue arises.
Yeah, one way you can see that in a practical way is at the White House during the day, if you walk into somebody's office and they don't have four screens on, that they're on Fox. If there is an international crisis of any sort or international issues that are up, they just flip it to CNN. And that's all over. I mean, it seems to be all over the White House. What do you do at night? Say something happens at night. How do you get information?
Well, it depends on, obviously, there haven't been too many where I've gotten a phone call in the middle of the night recently. But if it is something pressing that cannot wait, oftentimes I will find that White House communications folks will be up as well. So, in, you know, firing off the email to them, or if it's a phone call, or, you know, you always try to start with the email, which is a less intrusive way of trying to get folks to respond. But generally speaking, I mean, I have had the experience where if it's, you know, certainly pressing and it is obvious that it's going to be driving the stories, the coverage the next day, I will get a response from folks. But it's rare that, like I said, I can't even recall the last time that that's happened. But it's, you know, it's certainly something that I think since Dana Perino has been at the helm, you know, her BlackBerry skills are sort of renowned. So she understands that if we are calling her or emailing her or pressing her in the middle of the night, then, you know, that it's something major, that it's not just to kind of annoy her. So
right. There's, during the, I think it was during the Reagan, it could have been the first Bush administration, there was a rumor that Alan Greenspan had had a heart attack, and so the press secretary had to get involved at 3 o'clock in the morning, because the stock markets in the exchanges in Asia were being affected by it. So he then had to get Greenspan's communications people up so that they could step on it and say no, that it wasn't the case. But there can be a variety of things in addition to international crises. It's an international crisis that one would not have anticipated. One thing I wonder if you can tell us. We have talked to a lot of newspaper and magazine people who are all talking about the difficulties they are facing with the loss of circulation. And that has happened with television, with some television networks as well. But CNN has been growing.
Absolutely.
And can you tell us what you think the factors are in that, and what CNN itself has done as an organization to try to bring that about?
Well, I know that on the international side, for instance, CNN is broadening out to beyond just what has already existed in terms of more people in cities where they're going to be establishing bureaus now, mm-hmm. and I think some more probably announcements are in the pipeline. But .com is another area where I think a lot of the success, while we haven't necessarily seen sort of any kind of effects, at least not yet, it seems, we're in a good position, CNN, I think, because our .com traffic is amazing to me. I think I saw the latest statistic was something like, you know, 30 million unique users a month. I mean, I can't, it's unbelievable to think of those kinds of numbers. You think about how many people are watching network news, and this is the number of people that are actually going to that site. So it's I think a lot of it is, it's helping us on the TV side, because we are able to then push out more material in a lot of different on a lot of different mm-hmm. platforms. You know, we're not just providing what you see on air for the Situation Room. It's also sometimes, you know, a little blog item, or it's an interview that we've done that we're putting on .com that might be an opportunity for people who, you know, may want to learn a little bit more about something, uh-huh. and you know, be able to be able to click on an interview. We had that recently when I traveled with the president to the NATO summit, and the tail end of that visit was a meeting with President Putin. And of course, there's been a great deal of reporting about the relationship over the years between these two men, and even people who aren't necessarily following, you know, all the yeah. ins and outs of foreign policy with the U.S.-Russia relations are mindful of the fact that things have not gone as President Bush had hoped with President Putin. So we interviewed Peter Baker, who is the author of Kremlin Rising, as you know, and also Washington Post reporter, about sort of his view of the deterioration of that relationship through the years. And that was an example where we were able to, because it was a, you know, probably a 10-minute interview, we were able to put that on .com, and it drew a lot of traffic. And so those are the kinds of sort of interactive things that we're able to do mm-hmm. at CNN that I think has helped us, because we are not just you know, we're able to kind of take advantage of all of these, the new media that's out there. It all exists in CNN. We're all sort of learning as we go. But that was a recent example of how we take a story that I did my own television version report on, and then, you know, viewers are able to then also look at .com at the Wire story that we wrote, uh-huh. and then click on that interview. So sort of bringing a lot of pieces together, but that's something that we're looking to do more and more of at CNN, I think.
In planning out your coverage for a day, how do you do that?
You know, it's interesting because, as you noted, obviously a lot of the attention is on the campaign trail these days, and so a constant challenge is trying to determine what we can offer that's either, you know, we don't look to necessarily complement, but almost to contrast in mm-hmm. a way from the campaign trail when people are have sort of gotten their fill from our folks that are actually covering candidates, because obviously the president has really tried to be careful about getting too involved in what's happening on the trail. We're able to sometimes go the opposite direction and talk about something completely different and something completely unrelated. It's getting harder and harder to do now, you know, as, for instance, the Columbia Free Trade Agreement we're talking about. You know, the issue of free trade is a hot one on the campaign trail. But that's sort of the way we've tried to approach it from the White House beat. You know, my executive producer oftentimes will talk at the beginning of the day about you know, what the network is sort of focusing on, what it is that we might be seeing the president, what opportunities there are to have any news made at the White House, you know. Right. A lot of times you just kind of have to go with the flow of the day and see where what develops. But it's not really, you know, at this point, you know, it's not really that we're trying to necessarily compete with some of the rhetoric and some of the reporting uh-huh. out on the campaign trail. We're mostly trying to kind of focus on the story of this man as he goes through the final 9 months now. What is it that he is still trying to do? What is it that he really can do? The questions of influence continue to be big ones, of course. How much influence does he really have? And then sort of setting the table for the next president, for the next administration, what is it that he is trying to do in these final months as we lead up to the election to try and as best he can, for instance, the Bush-Putin relationship, I go back to that, you mm-hmm. know, a lot of our story was about the, you know, looking beyond
right.
the president. And so it's a constant challenge, I think, at the, you know, especially as we get closer and closer here, and as you're right, the election season it's fascinating to watch, but we're mm-hmm. also very mindful of the fact that he is a president that is, you know, commander-in-chief at a time when there are, you know, 140,000 troops in Iraq, and, you know, mm-hmm. there are still war in Afghanistan, and, you know, there are still issues that, of course, make this beat a lot of fun to cover, and it's just a matter of sometimes trying to, you know, present what we can to folks, you know, in a way that will be compelling, but it is challenging. There's a lot of uh-huh. there's a lot of times where we don't get on these days, but that's to be it's part of the territory, to be expected.
One of the tactics that the president seems to have developed this year to get some interest and also to be able to be active, but not be doing anything that requires the Congress to come in and make a judgment of one sort, whether it's legislation or treaties or anything. He's been going abroad, mm-hmm. and so it's as if every month he has been on the road. He's going somewhere around the world, as if he's taking. Wouldn't say it's a victory lap, but it's a last lap. Mm-hmm. And saying goodbye to leaders that he has known through his through what will be his 8 years, and then also highlighting in a way it's as if he's trying to shape what his legacy is. And so his trip to Africa was. Were you on the Africa trip?
I wasn't. Ed was on that trip.
Yeah, the trip to Africa seemed to be an example of that.
Absolutely.
Although it didn't get as much coverage, I think, as probably they would have liked. But Africa has been a central interest of his. Is that something that I don't know how much you can say about off the record sessions, but is that something that you see?
I know certainly the administration has. you know, been perhaps, the best way to say this, that officials have been aware that there has not been as much attention on the good that has been done under President Bush in Africa, particularly, that even people who were critics of this administration, when it comes to Africa, have you know, stood up and cheered over his initiatives right. there to fight AIDS, HIV/AIDS, yeah. to fight malaria. Yeah. Yeah. And I know from the reports that my colleague Ed Henry filed on the road, really this was an opportunity to try to highlight the good. This is what the president's goal was, really, is to kind of shine the spotlight on this, on the fact that really for pennies on the dollar, millions of lives are saved as a result of the actions that have been taken during the president's time in office. But, you know, it didn't get much play here in the United States. People obviously were tuning into other things, but I know my colleague Ed, he filed a lot of pieces for international mm-hmm. on that, and I think you know, the Bush administration understands that there are always going to be critics, but they definitely, I think, would have liked to have perhaps a little bit more coverage of that trip. But we certainly, I know from watching, we certainly did a lot of pieces, because there was also, in addition to that, just a lot of interesting color on that trip as well. And we have, in fact, in our White House unit at CNN, we've got one of the images that the president himself showed in talking about his trip to Africa when, I forget who the audience was exactly, but he...
It was for the Leon Sullivan Award.
That's right, that's correct. Yeah, that's right. He was doing the slideshow, and he showed the women in Tanzania who had these, I guess they were banners, or I'm not sure what to call them, but they were basically images of the president.
Yeah.
And they were wrapped around these women's bodies as sort of skirts, so that on their rears was the picture of the president. And it was one of those strange things that, you know, unless you were there, you couldn't really understand the significance of it. But now we have one of those banners hanging up in our White House unit at CNN as a sort of a, you know, as a reminder of just what a strange, funny world it is covering the president of the United States. But, you know, there was a lot of opportunity there for some fun moments too, and I remember some of that being chronicled as well, seeing some of the coverage of that. But yeah, all in all, Africa has certainly been an area where I think the administration has always maintained that there has not been enough sort of coverage of the good that's being done there.
Uh-huh. Do you all have a question? Yeah.
Hi, thank you for being here. I have basically a two-part question. The first is, you use the word they a lot when you were referring to the response from the administration, and I was wondering exactly who is they. Is it the press secretary? Is it the director of communications? Is it the president? And my second question is, I wanted to know the relationship between the director of communications and the press secretary. Who's more powerful? What exactly are their roles, and how do they intertwine, I guess?
Yeah, well, I can tell you that the they is all of the above. You said, you know, the press secretary, the communications director. It's really all of the above, because this administration, as you can attest to, is sort of notorious for message discipline, you know, so that it is speaking with one voice, really, at all times. And if you get pushback, it is, in fact, the same pushback that you would get. It might be in different degrees, depending on who's pushing at the moment, but it's sort of all of the above. Now, my understanding, and Martha, you probably know a lot more about this than I do, but the way it operates is sort of the communications director oversees sort of the big picture sort of strategy, as well as some of the day-to-day stuff, but primarily is sort of the big vision kind of mm-hmm. person. And then, of course, the press secretary deals with all of us on the daily basis and what our inquiries are. But my understanding is that she essentially reports to him, or they kind mm-hmm. of they have sort of that structure where she will, I guess, report to him. But you know, their roles are different. You know, I'm not talking to the communications director on a daily basis, but I, you know, certainly will be in, you know, communications in communication with Dana Perino, perhaps on an almost daily basis. So,
if you look at an organization chart of this White House, there's a community, you could call it a communications czar, and that person is responsible for all of the presidential publicity. So whether it's media affairs that deals with regional and local press, or it's speech writing, or it's the Office of Communication, which sets up events, or the press office, all of that is under communications. And I think in a way the importance of that is that the job of communications is selling, it's persuasion. And the job of the press office has always been information. And so those two can clash. I mean, is the role of the press secretary to go out there and provide information that is in response to what reporters are asking? Or is the press secretary's job to go out there and try to make a sale for the president? And generally, the press office has a much longer history. It was there way before the Office of Communications, which came in 1969. And so when it came in the Nixon administration, Nixon wanted to see communications drive the press office because he wanted it to reflect the priorities of the president. And I think that once you have televised daily briefings, then the White House is much more interested in using the press office not just for information, but for persuasion. And so that battle plays itself out, because what reporters want from a briefing is information that's in response to what they want. They don't want to talk about what the White House wants to talk about necessarily, but rather what their stories are and what they think is of interest. And so there have been much more of a battle, I think, once the briefing went on camera in January of 1995. But you think of those two offices and those two operations as kind of separate from one another, with the press office being daily information and the Office of Communications being more of the persuasion operation. And if you look at it over the years from, say, 69 forward, when there have been two offices, in Democratic administrations, that you usually had the A-team in the press office, and those two operations were separate. Like, say, in the Clinton administration, the Office of Communications wasn't telling the press office what to do. You would have pretty separate. I mean, they coordinated on some things, but it was not close in the same way. There was no overall communications person. The chief of staff was the one who would be involved in his. He would have a deputy so that would be involved in communications. So, say when Leon Panetta was the chief of staff, he himself was involved in communications. But later, when Erskine Bowles is chief of staff and not interested in communication, his deputy, John Podesta, was. And so he was involved in all of the setup of events and involved in the press office operation to some extent, too.
Just reminded me of a situation that actually happened recently when the president was giving a series of speeches on Iraq. What I would do is to sort of get an idea of substance for the next speech coming up. That is perhaps a question that I would direct to the press secretary and, you know, her deputies. What is the language that's going to be new? Is there going to be something different that we haven't heard before? And then for sort of the broader big picture view, from my perspective, of, you know, how does this fit in with what he is trying to sell on mm-hmm. Iraq? What is he trying to say? Then that would be a question that I would pose to the communications director, is what is the strategy here, the larger sort of strategy, you know, sort of the nitty-gritty details would be a Dana Perino question, for instance, you know, what, mm-hmm. You know, that it was going to be, this will be a series of speeches, this will be on, you know, reconstruction, this one will be on the military, this one will be on, you know, political progress. You know, all of that stuff kind of would be more of the substance. And then the larger view, again, about the mm-hmm. selling
you know, is it working? Why does he feel like he needs to necessarily break it down into three components here? What's your thinking on breaking it down into three pieces here, three chunks? Why do you think this is going to work this time versus, you know, what he's done in the past? I mean, those are the sort of strategic communications director questions that I would try and get answered. So I don't know if that explains just sort of divvying up again. And it's not like I'm necessarily talking to the White House communications director every day, but those conversations that we do have are, you know, the opportunities to take a step back and step out of the 24/7, you know, live shot wheel. I always say you feel like that sometimes the hamster on the live shot wheel, but then you're able to sort of sit down and think big thoughts and ask bigger questions of a communications director than perhaps the day-to-day questions that you might pose to the press secretary.
How many live shots do you do a day?
Oh, it can depend. I mean, you know, it's not unusual to have, if there's a breaking news story or something that has especially international ramifications, to do, you know, 3-4 live shots an hour, because in addition to CNN domestic, there is CNN international, there is headlines, there's also .com, the web. So you could be doing 4 live shots plus filing for radio, and that wheel continues every hour if it is a very you know, compelling story that that people are interested in. Now, we haven't had one like that. I'm trying to think of the last time where it actually was sort of wall-to-wall. Some of the Pope coverage was actually, of course, we had a lot of demand when the Pope was arriving on the South Lawn. Some of that was probably, you know, top of the hour, bottom of the hour, 2 live shots at the top of the hour, 2 live shots at the bottom of the hour. And, you know, that was probably sustained for the time we start our live wheel. 7 a.m. is our first sort of live availability from the White House till my shift would end around 3-ish. You know, and then Ed would take over, whoever the evening person is will take over. That's sort of the way we divvy up our shifts. So probably for the first 4 or 5 hours, you know, we were pretty much in demand at least 2 or 3 times an hour, I would say, if I'm remembering correctly. My voice kind of, I think that might have been a contributing factor to the laryngitis, I'm not sure.
When you go out and do a live shot, can you do 2 of them at the you know, 1 back-to-back? Is that the way you do it?
Yeah. Usually we try and schedule them that way just because it's, you know, it makes it easier than having to run back and forth from Milan. But, you know, a lot of times there are gaggles, as you know, and the briefing to contend with, and other events that make it difficult to try and sort of navigate. But that's where our producers come in to help us, you know, to play traffic cop, essentially, and let people know when we might be available and when we're not. But it can get a little crazy sometimes.
What is your week? Is your week a 7? Does it run from, you know, some weeks Wednesday to Monday?
Yeah, it varies. For instance, this week, I am sort of on this hybrid schedule, but I'll essentially be on call on Saturday and then in the Bureau on Sunday, and then off next week on Monday, and then Tuesday through Friday I'll be working, and then Ed has a weekend where he'll be on call and working. It's it really is very difficult to plan anything, because obviously your schedule depends on the president. So if there's an event or travel or something that requires staffing, you know, your plans are pretty much gone. So I've learned not to plan too far in advance. You know, you kind of have to have a very flexible schedule to be on the beat. And, you know, it's slowed down quite a bit as far as, you know, we're not traveling like I remember in 2004, obviously, when he was on the campaign trail, and he was sometimes in 3 cities in one day, and, you know, you never knew exactly where you were. I mean, that's essentially what my colleagues on the campaign trail are dealing with. So by comparison, we've got it relatively easy. His travel schedule, he's doing all these closed fundraisers, which is interesting, but, you know, he's not traveling nearly as much, of course, as he was in 2004. So it's actually quite nice.
Yeah, except abroad.
Except abroad, right.
Towson? question? Yep. Yellow shirt.
Some of the print reporters we've talked to.
Because we were talking about this before, obviously it's, you know, the lines have been blurred in such a way that, you know, people are asking, as they should, I think, questions about what constitutes news and where the line should be. You know, I think that what we, I can tell you what we do at the White House, obviously, is we try to present sort of very straightforward facts and you know, some analysis, of course, as well, but it's sort of a different, it's a different environment that we operate in now, where opinions do get the ratings, you know, people who are out there giving their commentary, people respond to that, but I think generally speaking, what we try and do is to not do that. You know, we at the in our unit, we try to really make sure that what we are giving people falls under the category of news and perhaps analysis, but doesn't cross that line into commentary. That's not our role. We sort of leave that to others to try and do.
Do you find that that what others have done on your network can end up affecting you? Like, for example, let's say last week Jack Cafferty talked about China and the Chinese government in a very unflattering and derogatory manner, and the Chinese government is really upset about it. Does the White House come to you all at all about a situation like that? Does anybody refer to it, try to do anything about it?
You know, I can't say that I've heard of any kind of fallout on that particular issue, but I know in the past, certainly things that have been said on our network, of course, will come back to us, you know, with White House officials taking issue with something that someone else has said, in which case it's a very delicate sort of situation where you have to try and obviously hear out the grievances and, you know, at the same time determine what your role is. Is it really just sort of being a conduit for that information then and taking it to the appropriate people? A lot of times that's what we do, and that's what we try and tell them, is that really, you know, we'll certainly take their comments and criticisms and concerns and present them to the appropriate folks, but you know, unless it's something that specifically we have said, we in the unit, you know, have said, it's very difficult to have an extended conversation about something that you know, has happened sort of outside of us.
Right. So you could just give them Lou Dobbs's phone number.
That's right. Here's the email address that you're looking for.
That's right.
That's right.
Yeah.
You said earlier that George Bush often seems much more articulate and seems to have much more nuanced opinions and a much more detailed understanding of world events when he's not in front of the cameras and on these off-the-record sessions. Given the fact that this 24-hour news cycle world that we live in right now seems to put him at a disadvantage all the time, do you think that he would have been able to better connect with the public or present a better image to himself in eras past when radio was the main means of communication or print was, or even, I mean, previous times before that, when it wasn't this sort of you're always on camera all the time kind of news culture?
Well, you know, that's a fascinating question. I never really thought about that.
Yeah.
It's such an interesting way to think about that, because certainly, you know, as we all know, cameras have an effect on anybody, whether you're just a regular citizen or the President of the United States, but it certainly magnifies things, doesn't it, in a way that, of course, radio and print don't necessarily. You know, I'm not sure. I think that it would be fascinating if there was some way to kind of put him in that position and you know, and see it. It definitely, in this YouTube era as well, you know, that is another factor that sort of, I think, has perpetuated, generally speaking, people's sort of fears of being on camera. But, you know, it definitely, I think, from what I have witnessed in the off-the-record sessions, it might be a different perspective that we all have. But at the same time, you know, as Professor Kumar pointed out, it was also an image, a television image as well, that was created as part of his mm-hmm. his re-election bid, as part of his election bid. You know, this was something that was used. Television was a medium that was used by the campaign, by the president, yeah. in order to get him into office in the first place. So while there might be an argument to be made that, okay, television might in some part be to blame for somehow distorting his image of who he is, at the same time, they, of course, have the administration, the campaign, have also sought to use that very same medium to their advantage. And if there, you know, if there is any kind of backlash as a result of from the image that was created, well, you know, you have to ask yourself, did they perhaps just go too far in that, and who's, you know, who's to blame? But the mm-hmm. radio, it's interesting you bring up the radio perspective, because I hadn't really thought of it in that perspective. Perhaps it could be an entirely different perception that people might have, you know, that he may not have had that same kind of aversion to radio interviews or radio coverage that obviously, you know, television has a lot of, it's fraught with peril, live television is, as we all know. So,
yeah.
You know, it's interesting to think about, a really good question.
And presidents just react so differently to different media. When Reagan was president, David Kennerly said that, who was a photographer, he was a White House photographer mm-hmm. for Ford, and he said that when you took a picture of Reagan, that Reagan had a sense of what a picture was. And so if you went in the Oval Office to take a picture, he would pick up a pen, he would do something so that it was an action shot. But he said when you put the camera down, he said it was like the life went out of him. And he said with George H.W. Bush, when you picked up the camera to take the picture, it was like the life went out of him. And you put it down, and then he and then he came to life.
Well, and that's an interesting point, because there is also, obviously, President George W. Bush has, as part of his experience, the yeah. knowledge of what happened with his own father, with, you know, in terms of media portrayals and such. So all of that, I think, has come into play in terms of perhaps an idea that television is not everything it seems, you know, that there's a sense of artificiality there that... I think he probably, the president, current president, you know, doesn't really necessarily respond well to. There's a sense, of course, in the briefing rooms for a time before Dana, I think things have subsided now that Dana is at the helm, but certainly there was a sense of daily, almost daily confrontation sometimes in the briefing room exchanges that I know some senior officials saw as obvious grandstanding on the part of some of my colleagues in the television world, that, you know, mm-hmm. it wasn't necessarily the journalism that was in at play there, that it was more about sort mm-hmm. of, you know, kind of putting on a show. And I think there's that element, but the idea that certainly images can be made or broken mm-hmm. based on a picture, it's, you know, it's, he's very sensitive to that, I think.
Yeah, so. And one of the rules that Karl Rove has had, even not just as Bush the candidate, but Bush the president, is that you win the picture, and that's when you win a new cycle. Is if you've won the picture, and so they've put a lot of attention on television, and how to provide the best shots, whether it is putting a background so that you know what the president is saying, even if the sound is off on a television. They wanted people to be able to know what he's talked about.
I remember that from the 04 campaign quite clearly.
Yeah.
I mean, you didn't even need to turn the sound up, as you said, to know that the president's message of the day was, you know, strengthening Social Security, or, you know, it was,
yeah,
it was very clear because literally the wall behind him would be plastered with the phrase every few feet or so. You know,
yeah,
it's no detail was too small for them, whether it be the audiences involved. Also, I remember that from the campaign trail as well, that oftentimes the backdrops would be, of course, friendly audiences, because this is a White House that understands images do matter, and
mm-hmm,
so no detail was spared.
Yeah. Towson? Yep.
You said earlier that sometimes your stories get bumped. I was wondering, who decides that? Is there like a chain of command, or like one omnipotent editor or something?
Yeah. Oh no, I wish it was that simple. No, it's a complex thing, actually. I mean, I hate to sound like I'm, you know, sidestepping the question, but it really sort of just does depend on a lot of things. The fact that if it happens, let's say, closer to Situation Room time, for instance, there's, you know, one set of producers that deals with that show, and you know, in essence, Wolf and his producers will make the editorial decisions. If it's something that happens in the American Morning Hours, there's another set of producers. But sometimes it's just outside events that nobody can control. I mean, if there's compelling breaking news happening somewhere, heaven forbid, a school shooting, something that, you know, completely overshadows whatever the story is that we were working on, you know, it's quite conceivable that they will float us, as they like to say, and then they'll float us right out of the show. So, you know, they'll tell us, well, we'll come to you, and then the next thing you know, it's the hour is over and you've not been on. But I mean, that's just the nature of, again, the cable news operation. You know, you have to kind of go, you have to be very flexible, and they go where the most compelling pictures are sometimes and the stories are. And if it's you're covering a speech that the president has made where he's not necessarily made news, but it might be interesting enough for them, and they weren't necessarily drawn to that story in a very compelling way, but they thought, well, you know, this is the president going on record about the economy again, we should have that. Perhaps that might be bumped, depending, you know, on breaking news. It's just a variety of factors, but there's not one overarching voice of authority on that. It really is just situationally dependent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was wondering how much you consult with outside sources or officials on just to question or analyze the prepackaged information and official statements that the White House puts out, because I think that could be it just in the 24/7 environment that could be a tendency, and you might not have the opportunity to analyze that, and therefore just push a straight White House agenda, and I was wondering how you deal with that.
Yeah, no, that's a great question, because it is something that has been a challenge, is trying to make sure that you do have outside perspectives and you do have outside voices, whether they come from the Hill or a think tank or somewhere completely different. But what we've done in our unit, and I think we do this well, is we're able to look ahead. We've got a team of producers that is always looking at the schedule to see what's coming up, what agenda item might be highlighted, and who the outside perspectives might be that we need to get. If it's not on camera for an interview necessarily, then at least it's a background conversation that can be set up with us, so that going into that day, we're not completely at the mercy of whatever it is the White House messages, so that we're always making sure we have a critical eye towards whatever the issue is. It's not just this singular play-by-play of what the officials would like us to, you know, to say. So it's an excellent question, though, because it can be very difficult at times if you're bombarded with a number of issues at once. I always say that all beats lead to the White House. You know, Justice Department, Defense Department, State Department, all these issues can somehow, of course, be traced to our beat. So it can sometimes be a tricky proposition to try and look at what's coming up on the president's schedule, on his agenda, what issues might be ripening on the Hill that might prompt some sort of presidential communication, whether it be him coming out to talk about free trade or some sort of veto threat or something, that we can make sure we're ahead of the game. It's something we, you know, we really strive to do on a weekly basis, and you know, it's a challenge, but it's our responsibility too as well.
Yeah. Let's take one question from each place, and then let Elaine go.
I haven't been coughing too much, though.
So. No, you sound good. So I hope you hold out for tomorrow.
Ahead.
Yeah. So Towson, one last question.
I think it's absolutely important to cover the mm-hmm. vice president, especially this vice president. But, and this is the point of contention that has really sort of made us want to pull our hair out sometimes. This vice president operates, his communication staff operates completely separate from what we in, you know, on the White House beat deal with our contacts in the press office on a daily basis. There's a separate communications sort of mm-hmm. team in place, and it's talk about difficult to try and extract information from. Boy, that is a really tough nut to crack. I mean, it's a very small circle of people, and we don't get the vice president's schedule, unlike the president's schedule, mm-hmm. which we get. We get it sometimes, sometimes not. More often, we don't. So we're not always sure where the vice president is. And, of course, the perfect example of being in the dark was the Harry Whittington shooting his colleague, his friend in the face. And, you know, all of us were scrambling to try and put the pieces together on that. But even in that instance, it was very apparent to us that within the White House Communications Office, the press office, mm-hmm. that we deal with every day, there was a sense of frustration about, you know, the way things were handled. And so we think there should be more coverage, but they're really, you know, it's very difficult when there's no access. Mm-hmm. So.
And the Washington Post got a Pulitzer Prize for a series that it did on Cheney. And it took them over a year, two reporters over a year, to develop the stories that they had. So it gives you some idea how impenetrable it is. But on the other hand, if you look at the memoranda that were submitted in the Lewis Libby case, and you look at those memoranda and some of the notes of people like Kathy Martin, mm-hmm. who now had worked for Cheney, and now she's in the West Wing, but you look at those memoranda and you see that they have press strategies that included regular White House correspondence. Mm-hmm. A question here? No? Okay. Well, thank you very much, Elaine.
Okay. Oh, no. Okay.
No, I have to read in the Sunday New York Times. Which one of you gets to go to Crawford for the wedding? That's what I want to know. And have you been, this is another example of control of news, right? That is, there's been almost nothing released. And I'm just curious, you know, something even like that, how you all feel about it.
Well, I can tell you, I just learned I will be going. So I'm learning how difficult it's going to be to try and put something together because, as you know, just by virtue of having the wedding on the ranch, that can assure no pictures other than whatever they decide to release, if anything at all, which, you know, we're hoping for something. But it is frustrating to try and... obviously, a story like that is generating a lot of interest and will generate a lot of interest as it gets closer. But for our purposes, television, we're going to be at a little bit of a loss here. So we'll have to be creative. And I'm sure I can tell you already, we're looking for ways to perhaps you know, the president's known for his dancing abilities on the, like, the Africa trip, for instance. So we're maybe going to try and present some possibilities of what the dancing might look like, at least. But other than that, you know, we're going to be trying to really work it to get some kind of imagery out there. I would imagine there might be a photo release or two, but that alone obviously isn't enough to necessarily satisfy the, I'm sure, voracious appetite people are going to have for that story. So we'll see. You'll check with me in a few weeks, and we'll see what we've got.
Well, speaking of the Sunday New York Times, the Sunday New York Times had a long piece developed through a Freedom of Information Act suit that the reporter had with government agencies. You can't use it against the White House because they're not covered by FOIA. But getting information about contacts between analysts for cable news and the Pentagon. And I wondered what policies that that CNN has had about using generals and other military people, and to what extent that they go to find out what kind of contacts they have, whether it's a relationship with something like Lockheed or Martin Marietta, and also with the Pentagon itself.
Well, for the military analysts, I can tell you, and I haven't really spoken to anybody about this at CNN, but the policy for the military analysts has been to have the written disclosures of where the, of what income they might have, so as to kind of head off any conflicts, any potential conflicts. Now, in that piece as well, it was there was a discussion about one particular analyst and his subsequent ties. It was later learned, but not until several years after, I think it was 07, when someone took a closer look at the disclosure form and essentially asked more questions about it, and it was determined that the analyst should no longer, you know, should part ways with CNN. I can tell you now, I'm sure that there will be a lot more scrutiny when it comes to looking at these written disclosures, but it is a difficult situation because, to a certain extent, you're of course relying on those ability on the trustworthiness of those people to come forward themselves and disclose that you know they've got these written disclosures, but it may not be readily apparent at first glance what exactly the ties might be or potential conflicts of interest might be. But I'm sure now there will be a lot more scrutiny, a lot more attention paid to those written disclosures.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, thank you very much, Elaine.
Thank you.
And good evening. I wanted to tell you all that Saturday is the White House Correspondents Association dinner. And in addition to having a comedian and having the president speak, they give out awards for White House reporting. And two of the people that we've had this semester have received awards. Alexis Simmendinger of National Journal is receiving the Aldo Beckman Award for comprehensive coverage of the White House and of the presidency. Deb Brinkman of Associated Press is receiving an award for spot news coverage. And Ed Henry, your colleague
That's
Ed
right.
Henry, is receiving the third award. Glad to see it. And if you've missed their interviews, the interviews that Deb and Alexis did, you might want to look at them. So, thanks very much, Elaine.
Thank you.